This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So updating the counting that's going on in places like Georgia and Nevada from yesterday. Remember, Georgia is doing a hand recount at present that is scheduled to be completed by Wednesday this week.
You know, they're also calling it an audit, not a recount, but whatever.
The hand recount revealed that a replacement scanner in Floyd County, Georgia, did not tabulate over 2,500 ballots. That resulted in a net gain of about 800 votes for President Trump. That's not necessarily an indication that another 13,000 odd votes will be found in this recount, but it is interesting. It is something worth taking note of, particularly as there is some sniping going on between the Georgia Secretary of State and other Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, about the administration of the election in Georgia, with calls previously for Raffenberger to step down. So that's pending, but it is interesting to note that, the hand count versus the machine count, that a scanner failed in one particular county. So one would wonder, well, maybe there were administrative errors or worse in a county that could be really material, that could move numbers much more quickly, like, say, Fulton County. Because remember the premise here, four metropolitan areas in this country in which Joe Biden outperformed Hillary Clinton: Atlanta, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, and Detroit.
Outperformed Hillary Clinton by sitting in his basement. I mean, think about that. All of those cities, I don't know.
There's something very peculiar about it, because it was those cities that were in those material states and not other urban centers around the country. So if there is this surge for Joe Biden and against President Trump, some combination of the two, it is interesting to note that it was most pronounced in those swing states. Now, you could argue it's possible. Well, that's where the campaigns focused their efforts, and so that's because they were in those swing states, the big metropolitan areas in those swing states. That's where Democrats focused their efforts. So that's where you got the increment. Maybe. Perhaps. Sure. We'll see. To the extent that this can all be checked out. But it is very interesting that all of the anomalies, statistical anomalies, have exclusively benefited Joe Biden. You're starting to get, when you start to layer them on, the number of people who voted only in the presidential race in Atlanta versus completing the rest of the ballot voting in the other races, and overwhelmingly like 99.9% Biden voters to Trump voters for president.
Yeah, 818 voted for Trump only, and 95,807 voted for Biden only. What, even in a state where he had two open Senate seats.
Right.
That's completely lazy or completely planned?
Not open Senate seats. Purdue, sitting
right,
senator.
But okay.
Yes, but two Senate
two
races.
Two Senate races. It's a joke.
So, yeah. And, you know, so you start to layer these things in, these statistical anomalies, and you start to feel like they are greater odds of this all happening to the benefit of one candidate than that one candidate winning the Powerball. But, okay, perhaps. And then in Nevada, this came over the transom late yesterday, and I don't know that it – well, I'll tell you the story. You make your own decision.
Okay.
Adam Laxalt, the former attorney general of Nevada, who is on the Trump legal team, who was at the press conference announcing the suit that they filed in Nevada with respect to election irregularities. The Clark County Commission just threw out an election that represents almost one-sixth of the total votes cast in Clark County, because there were too many discrepancies to be sure that the results in that election can be certain. There was 153,000 votes in that election. So that's true, but you have to continue reading or continuing paying attention, because the Clark County Commission also certified the election results in Clark County with the exception of that single Clark County commissioner race. So, in other words, that doesn't change the 40,000, 43,000 vote spread between Trump and Biden in Nevada. I think people saw that and like, oh, 153,000 votes were thrown out. No, no. That election is pending for that county commissioner seat, but it didn't change the Clark County total for President Trump in Nevada.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Do you think there's still hope, Dan? Is there still hope for President Trump?
Well, I want to see the litigation play out, and you have this recount going on in Georgia. You have a recount that is pending in Wisconsin. I think you have material constitutional issues because of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Pennsylvania. So there's, I don't know why we can let processes play out for years if they redound to the benefit of Democrats. We can't let a process play out for 30 days if it involves President Trump. That doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, could do it for the Democrats. We could do it for Al Gore.
Well,
we can't do it for Orange Man Bad.
Right. And again, the way to ensure people have faith in our elections is to allow legal processes to be pursued and legal remedies to be sought to their appropriate ends.
Well, regardless if he wins or loses, I've lost all faith in the system. I can't stand mail-in ballots. And I can't stand early voting. Do you know they're getting their mail-in ballots tomorrow in Georgia already? So you have from now until January 5th to vote? I mean, it's ridiculous.
6 weeks before the November 3rd election, now another 6 weeks before that January 5th election down there.
You know what that means? 6 weeks of possible fraud. What are they going to conjure up next? I don't like it. I like Election Day voting. Maybe make it, 2 days so people can get there, if the lines are long. But this system has got to change.
Just in Vegas, in Clark County, Nevada, this is just interesting because it speaks to the there's nothing to see here crowd.
Oh.
And nobody's ever claimed orders of magnitude when it comes to fraud or the competent administration elections greater than exist. We're just saying it exists because it exists and because you're creating more opportunities to exist, you're giving the opportunity for scale. And that's relevant because it goes back to the simple question. Whose vote shouldn't matter? Yours? Mine? The Registrar of Voters, Joe Gloria, delivering a full report to the county commissioners in a special meeting yesterday, he revealed the following discrepancies. 936... in ballots, 710 with mail-in precincts, 121 in early voting precincts, 105 on election day, 6 voters voted twice. So these are discrepancies. 936 with the in-person, 710 with the mail-in, 121 early voting precincts, 105 on election day, 6 voters voting twice. He talked about the discrepancies sort of categorically. Inadvertent canceled votes, voter check-ins, reactivated voter cards, duplicate activations, check-in errors. They found that of the 60,000 provisional ballots cast in the election, 57,800 were accepted, 2,243 were rejected, 115 voters had already voted, 142 voted in the wrong district or wrong precincts, 8 were not eligible to vote, 1,925 were not registered to vote and thus not eligible. 53 did not provide adequate proof of residence or a valid identification. So the other statistical anomaly is, we talked about it yesterday with respect to Georgia. 6 times the number of absentee ballot or mail-in ballots cast 2020 versus 2016. 6 times more, 12x fewer spoil ballots. By a factor of 12, there were fewer spoil ballots, despite an increase 6x. And we've seen the spoilage rates in other largely vote-by-mail elections, even this year, as we've talked about at some length, Paterson, New Jersey, New York, particularly Paterson, New Jersey. Spoilage rate that came in at 20%. Spoilage rate normally for mail-in ballots, cited a 2012 New York Times story on this in advance of the 2012 presidential election, Obama's re-election. They were concerned at the time with the New York Times about an increase in mail-in balloting, and they talked about the incidence of spoilage. 2% is the handle. In Georgia, it was 0.24%. So that many more people voting, and they were that much more conscientious. It goes to the great public education campaign that happened in Georgia with respect to mail-in voting. Perhaps. Does that strike you as odd? Again, the layering of the statistical anomalies that all redound to the benefit of Joe Biden. It's worth exploring, and that's what Trump is doing by pursuing his legal rights in courts of law. And it is worth noting those who are hysterical about having him just concede rather than waiting for the courts to adjudicate these matters are the same people who will talk about process and the rule of law and courts of law when it comes to their interests. So what you really have is some people who believe in the process and the system of government that's been set up and believe that people should be equal before the law and be able to equally pursue their rights under the law. And you have people who really are not proponents of the rule of law. They're proponents of their interests. And sometimes the rule of law is helpful to them and they'll use it. And sometimes it's unhelpful to them and they'll discard it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Have you seen the meme? Six are allowed at Thanksgiving, but 30 for a funeral. So I'll be holding a funeral for my pet turkey that will pass away on November 26th. Refreshments will be provided.
Well, no, in lieu of flowers, please bring a side dish.
There you go.
Or some alcohol.
What is Governor Jelly Belly doing for Thanksgiving? Will he be spending it in Florida or Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it started out very nice. You know, what are you doing differently this year, you and Dr. Nzeki, since you're telling us that we can't have guests at our house? What are your plans?
Oh, I have often had friends, many friends who don't live, whose families, rather, are not in Illinois and who can't go to their families and therefore would otherwise be by themselves. We've had those families over to join our Thanksgiving. That's been the history of our Thanksgivings for NK and me.
Billionaires who are solo on Thanksgiving.
That's not something we're doing this year, as you can imagine, yeah. And we're encouraging people to stay at home.
All right, so then since he lives in Chicago, I had to ask.
It's nice, though. I mean, worth noting that it's really nice when a billionaire will open his home to billionaires who don't have family in town during the holidays.
Yeah. It's very gracious, though. Yeah. And then the real question comes.
Since you live in Chicago, I mean, are you going to follow the no travel advisory that Mayor Lightfoot put into place at 6 a.m. this morning?
Yeah, I don't know what that says exactly, and I don't know exactly what my plans will be, but I'll certainly, you know, be happy to share.
The Second City blog said that your family's already in Florida and all.
Well, I think you already know. I mean, we have a place in Florida, so.
Right. We're not going to address rumors from random blogs online. So
he just did.
You must know what the mayor's plan is. I mean,
I actually have not seen what the mayor put out this morning. I've been very busy, as you can imagine. We are.
Sure. It gets better. Thanksgiving arrangement.
Well, I know there was something new this morning I heard. Actually, I don't think there was a travel ban, but I think there was a discouragement. Yeah.
No, discouragement.
Wait, why did you leave out the best part? Marian Ahern then says, well, where are you going to be for Thanksgiving? And he says, I don't know. Are you going to be in Illinois for Thanksgiving? Well, and he says, I may.
He's not there. He's very busy. He doesn't know where he's going to be. I mean, he has people for that. Not to mention, I mean, the logistics of moving that much weight around. that is not something that is easily planned. That takes some time.
Well, I mean, so it's a travel advisory. And if he does go to Florida, guess what? When he comes back, according to the mayor, he has to self-quarantine for 2 weeks.
Oh, boy.
Before he can go back into general pop, if you know what I mean.
We'll miss you, Governor Pritzker, while you're gone.
But doesn't this his ignorance, and he just not knowing what the city mandates are, or advisory, excuse me.
I got to tell you, it's hard for anybody to keep up because it's so arbitrary, and it's sort of a daily event. So I can understand he's worried about his shutdown policies. He can't be worried about every other big city mayor's shutdown policies like Lori Lightfoot, not to mention that they probably have some disagreements. I don't think they're particularly close, so he probably just doesn't want to address it at all. As you know, well, he has a place in Florida, so he addressed that. So his family's down in Florida. Well, as you know, I have a place in Florida. Okay, so your family is down in Florida. Mm-hmm. It's lovely down there. You should go, actually. You should check it out.
I'd go. I said that
no,
yesterday.
I'll go. I hope he does go. I'll meet him down there, and we can hang out, and I'll take him around and introduce him to the fellas so he can make some friends. And he can see how a state that is rational operates, but also responsibly. I was down in Florida last week, and you have businesses that, you know, please wear a mask. So you wear a mask in the business. You be respectful. Nobody's right. looking to pick a fight. But by the same token, it is not this hysteria, nor is there this this belief in messianic politicians that you are to say how high when they say jump for COVID. It's just a completely different culture, completely different environment. It is a much more sane one. Perhaps if he was able to be drop shipped to Florida, that he may come back with some lessons learned. I doubt it, but it would be nice to have a conversation about what he experienced in Florida versus what he's doing in Illinois.
But people in Illinois who are stuck here, who don't have the means to leave, to go to houses and other places, Dan, want to know that their leaders are suffering like they are. And that is clearly not happening here. That he's going through same thing. He's shutting down businesses. He's ruining people's livelihoods. Yeah. And he just gets to go to warm, sunny Florida on his private jet to meet the wife and kids that are down there. And that's fine. I'm not want to deny him Thanksgiving, but he's telling us.
Well, you're not
and so
going
is Dr.
to. There's
Zeke.
Nothing that's going to stand between him and a turkey. So you can try and deny him all you want. That's like trying to deny that prehistoric gator down in Valencia.
Oh, yeah.
That's like trying to deny him the water. Trying to deny prescription turkey, good luck.
No, but I'm just saying that he's telling us that we can't have people at our house.
I get it. Do you really care if your betters suffer the way that you suffer under their edicts? Do you really care?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I'm not convinced that people really care. I think it's something that's easy to bitch about. But I don't think it motivates people. I think most people who are bitching about it were Pritzker voters.
Yeah, here's one. All of these politicians are going to do exactly what they want to do and what they told you not to do. They're going to travel and enjoy all of their families and are able to join them during the holidays.
I don't understand. Is that a Pritzker voter?
I'm sorry. That's a text message from a Democrat who voted for Pritzker.
Yeah. Okay. Well. So what? So what's the problem? Because if you aren't locked in with the Democrat Socialists in Chicago and Illinois, then this is what you expect because you know better about your so-called betters, don't you? You know that their hypocrisy is a feature, not a bug. You understand that the Vanguard class. One of the indicia of their existence is that they do not have to abide the rules that they impose. So you're not surprised. The people that are getting all whipped into a frenzy over this, heaping moral scorn on Pritzker, are Pritzker voters. So what?
We get what we paid for? I mean, it's just like these rules are so arbitrary. Yeah, you know what? We do. And people are actually staying inside their homes. They're locking themselves, voluntarily locking themselves inside their homes.
Less traffic for me.
People are voluntarily shutting down their restaurants and bars.
Okay. Well, just don't come knocking on my door for a bailout. I mean, what are you trying to do? Save people from themselves?
They're trying to scare people into compliance.
What are you trying to do?
What am I trying to do?
Are you trying to save people from themselves? Because if you're trying to do that, that's a fool's errand, especially
here.
Well,
that's what I've been doing. I've been
How's
doing.
It going?
It's not going well, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a coach without a team, and I'm trying to coach these idiot, lobotomized fools that are walking around with diapers on their face when nobody's standing next to them outside, that it's okay. You don't have to live like this.
Well, there are some people that, again, this isn't at my behest, but there are some people that are standing up to their betters. Even in places like New Trier, you think, well, this is betters versus betters. Well, not really. School union, the teachers union there, of course, controls the schools.
Yes.
And all the administrators are champagne socialists, of course. But parents rallied outside New Trier High School to get kids back in the classroom. But and a couple hundred people showed up.
Good.
And the response from the Nutrier Teachers Union, to be clear, the impediment to safe in-person instruction is COVID-19 and not our faculty. No, it's your faculty not willing to come back to work. And by the way, this is, you know, for all of the scientific consensus folks, I mean, the scientific consensus across the span of people who disagree about masks, who disagree about lockdowns, it's difficult to find. Think about FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, who's even sort of former FDA commissioner, sort of, you know, sort of very, very middle in terms of some of the lockdown policies and the mask mandates and so on and so forth. Very few people who are not part of the teachers union or their acolytes. Very few people can you find from the scientific community who support this lockdown of schools, this lack of in-person education in schools. You can't find people.
Even Dr. Awardi is changing her mind with Chicago Public.
Talking about serious people. Okay.
She's in charge of our kids. I'm sorry. I wish she wasn't, but that's the life we live.
Well, I know, but
But she's quoting studies that you've quoted here on this program that it's safe for kids to go back to school.
Well,
they have a better rate of getting it at home than they do in class.
The evidence is overwhelming, but the politicians don't care. And why don't they care? Because they're beholden to the teachers union. They're not beholden to you. I mean, I don't understand why people don't remember that that is the case. They're beholden to the teachers union when it comes to things like school choice and other K through 12 reforms. They're beholden to the teachers union when it comes to campaign financing and foot soldiers. But somehow they wouldn't be beholden to the teachers union when it comes to a teachers union that and their members, some of them at least, many of them in some districts, don't want to go back to work. But the parents want them back to work to educate their kids because the evidence is overwhelming about the negative impact on kids' intellectual development if they're not in the classroom, particularly at the lower grades. And yet it's not happening. Well, why isn't it happening? Not now is it resonating? Tell your friends. Now do you get it? It's just like this Democrat who texted you, Democrats, these guys are going to do one thing and tell us to do another. Yeah, I know. Welcome to the party. Mm-hmm. Remarkable. You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be embarrassed at how dense you are, that you haven't connected these dots that are so obviously connected. Lo, these many years across wide spans of issues related to your quality of life and that of your kids.
Well, Dan,
hello.
I know. Well, how do you talk your way out of this one? After you tell people to stay home, not have multiple families in your house, have Thanksgiving alone, don't travel. I mean, how when he says this, how do you talk about how do you get out of this?
Will you be in Illinois for Thanksgiving?
That is my hope, but I will let you know.
We all hope he is in Illinois, but hope
his spokesperson,
hope he and his billionaire friends and family have a nice Thanksgiving. That's the important thing.
Okay, stop. His spokesperson last night when pressed, you know, is he going to stay here in Illinois?
Hey, who cares?
She says the governor lives
his... Why are you obsessed about this?
The governor lives his life day to day at this point.
No question, all do.
Right.
He's just like us. He puts his, pantaloons on one leg at a time, and he lives his life one day at a time. Just like Bonnie Franklin did, just like Valerie Bertinelli did, just like we do. He's just a regular guy like us. Of course, he's the Governor Horn of Plenty. And, he's in Illinois, he's in Florida. I mean,
Wisconsin.
Wherever. So? What is the point?
Point is because they set rules that they don't follow, and that is bothersome.
Kidding. Yeah. Is it? It's bothersome. Why? Why do you care?
Because they get to live their lives, and a lot of us are not living our lives to the fullest. We're existing, not living, because of their draconian measures they put in place.
So what? That's how it is. That's how it is on everything. Why would COVID be any different? I mean, you're really going to pretend to be surprised? You have to muster this outrage?
No, I am surprised. And I'm surprised at how he was not even... Because he did not even know about the shutdown advisory for the city of Chicago.
Why does he have to know about it?
Because he lives in Chicago.
Excuse me. Why does he have to know about it? Follow your own logic, if you could.
How could he not know about it? Does he not own a TV?
Okay. Okay. I'll slow it down to see if you can follow your own logic.
Yes.
Well, he doesn't know about it. And it's also offensive to you that he doesn't pay attention to the rules because he just makes his own. So then go back to the first and explain to me how you're surprised that he doesn't know about it when you've already conceded that he doesn't follow the rules. He just makes his own.
He's not following the rules that Mayor Lightfoot set. He didn't know about
them. Oh, my gosh. Oh, whew, wow. Chet and Lyle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. This is a prime example of why this is the worst governed state in American history.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just one of the things you've always mentioned, Dan, the most important election in your community is your school board election. And for people who are paying attention, you have until about the middle of December to file nominating petitions to get on the ballot for the April election. I encourage everybody to do that because the only way you make change is to put together majorities of like-thinking people to throw out the embedded status quo.
Too late. Thank you. Thanks for the call, Chet. Agreed. It's too late. And then what are you going to do? Then these board members, these school board members will get on these boards, the school board members Chet would wish would run. And then what they'll do? They'll get captured by the superintendent, the teachers union, and the most vocal parents. You think you're going to change a school board and you're going to change a school? It's theoretically possible. Have I seen that happen? Yes. Is it a wildly rare occurrence in Illinois? Yes. I mean, again, that is the process. I don't disagree with Chet. I wish it, you know, were as easy as 1, 2, 3. But that's not how it actually works in practice. You know why? Because this is a state beset by cowardice. This is a state full of people who are cowards. And most of those cowards are in positions of authority. And few of those cowards actually get challenged. And I'm talking about across the political spectrum, to the extent Republicans are even relevant anywhere. Alex in Hinsdale.
Hey, good morning, guys. My whole point out of all this is if there needs to be another nail in the coffin of Illinois for people to get out, whether it's Lightfoot in front of her house saying stay inside, 1,000 people around her without a mask, or if it's Pritzker taking toilets out to avoid tax, but then wanting us to pay more tax. If you just take a look at Zillow, at what homes in hot areas supposedly like Kinsdale, Glencoe were selling for 10 years ago, the prices on many of these houses are half, but the property taxes are more. I don't think Illinois has a chance left. It's going to have to get really, really bad.
Thanks for the call, Alex. Jim in Crown Point.
The whole crux of the matter is there's no consequences for anything anymore. Shut down the schools. Don't have any school. Don't pay the teachers. Don't pay the government workers till we get this figured out. I bet you everybody be clamoring to go back to work.
Yeah, maybe, but who's going to do that? I mean, that starts to the premise that, you know, what we have here is a lack of ideas. Nobody knows what to do. No, people know what to do. Oh, yeah, you impose consequences to the actions. Right. Who's going to oppose them? Who? How's that happen? Here's what we do. We shut down the schools. We don't pay teachers. Or we say, if you're not going to come back to work, then we don't pay you. Or we lay off teachers. Oh, that's great. Great idea. Who's going to do it? Where's that going to happen? Pete and Racine.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that hopefully the governor, with his lack of compassion for all the people that are working in restaurants and such, which aren't right now, I hope he is at least, with his cooking staff, paying them time and a half or double time, because they are obviously working a lot of hours to keep this guy in food.
There's no question, Pete. And, you know, for Thanksgiving, J.B. Pritzker always brings in chefs from 3-star Michelin-rated restaurants who don't have anywhere to go on Thanksgiving, along with the billionaires. He's very generous, very thoughtful.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Because they got the beat. The Campus Beat, the Campus Beat. Yeah, the Campus Beat.
Yeah, time for an installment of Campus Beat. Talk about the end of college as we know it, question mark.
And at school.
And perhaps, yeah, the end of education from pre-K through post-secondary, at least as we knew it, pre-COVID. But first, I think he's a first-time caller, so we'll provide some deference. Nathan in Fond du Lac.
Yes, I'm going to tell you I love you guys' show and the perspective and the conservative viewpoints. But I find it really amazing that this country has lost its basic history. Well, keep kids out of school and you'll get this. Is what about for the people, by the people, not because I have a ton of cash and I'm over the people and you're going to do as I say, not as I do. Mm-hmm. Where does this come from in this country? And when have we let it slip so far that this is the area that our kids can't even see and don't even know that that's what the Constitution states?
Yeah. Well, I take that as a rhetorical question, Nathan, but I think we've said this on this show right about from the outset. You're willing to allow the state to liquidate your home. You're willing to allow the state to effectively and substantially hurt your child's intellectual and social development, their future economic prospects. I can't reach you. Nobody can. You don't want to be reached.
How do we fight back?
It's a coalition of the willing, and it's going to be a motivated minority, as it always is. But you're going to have to allow some people to chart their own course, wash your hands of them, not as human beings, but in terms of spending your time trying to stop sheep from being sheared. They're sheep. They get sheared. And that's what the politicians that you're talking about count on. The consent of the governed? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, the question would be, and the consent of the governed, is that taught at the K through 12 level? Is it taught at the collegiate level? Where did this come from? Well, I don't know. How about four or five generations of Marxist indoctrination in most of our educational system that conservatives have ceded to the left? Could that be a source of it? And so from the baby boomers forward, it has been from the Wilson administration forward, but particularly from the last from the baby boomers forward for the last 50 years, it has been a fairly steady march towards socialism with some interregnums, the Reagan years, the Trump years. But in some respects, obviously, the government grew under Trump. And it grew under Reagan, too. Now, he didn't have control of Congress as 8 years, as just as Trump didn't have control of the House for two of his four so far. So, that's an issue. But I'm just saying, look at the last 50 years. Even when we're winning, we're losing. Culturally. So, you know, where did this come from? It came from people saying today, where did this come from? Who weren't paying attention to what was happening for the last 50 years from pre-K through post-secondary, for starters. And then that radiating out into all of the other cultural and civic institutions. And you buying the, we need to find common ground where no common ground exists because the worldviews are mutually exclusive. You either promote a worldview that is rooted in our individual liberties as enshrined in the Constitution, or you promote a worldview that is rooted in a government-centric society that works around the Constitution. What's winning right now and has been for, again, half a century, arguably more? How did we get here? Slowly and then suddenly, to borrow from Hemingway. So how do we walk back? Perhaps, since I don't want to be completely fatalistic here, I don't really think I'm being fatalistic. I think I'm just describing what happened. But people want to just, well, how do we just make it all go away? You can't. It is not. You're not going to flip a light switch and bring us back to, you know, what the founders envisioned a representative republic should look like, and how it should function. It's going to be a fight for every inch of turf on the way back to sanity and, you know, something approaching a minarchy. So maybe, though, maybe there are some silver linings because of this pandemic. Maybe some of the trends that were afoot that were positive, rethinking college education, for example, maybe that will increase in pace. And that'll be good, because if you devolve power away from the academy, that's a good start. If you impose economic consequences for the fraud that is being run on so many families by so many universities around the country, that would be a good start. Reorders the balance. So it's worth noting, for example, that through November 2nd, the common application for college had nearly 8% fewer first-year applications than the same period last year, and 10% fewer applicants. The common application is used by more than 900 colleges and universities, you know, a little less than a third. Early data show that the number of high school seniors who have filled out the FAFSA, you know, the federal application for federal student aid, free application for federal student aid, I should say, the FAFSA filers, down 16% from this time last year. The numbers are even lower among students of color and those in high poverty high schools in rural areas. That's not necessarily good news, depending on their educational opportunities. But I don't necessarily bemoan the significant decline in applications and both for entrance as well as for federal aid. Common App data shows 16% decline to both applicants who requested fee waivers and those who would be first-generation college students. Tom Reinhardt, who's the president of the National Association for College Admission Counseling, said he knows of peer schools with applications down by at least 10% so far this year. You know, that becomes a real financial problem for universities, and they don't have to be run by Bernie Sanders' wife to fail if they continue to hemorrhage students. And this was sort of the basis for this piece by Douglas Belkin in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, talking about the end of college as we know it. And the bottom line is very few college students are getting a return on their college education that they would take if they otherwise anticipated what that ROI would be before they made the decision to go. From Oren Cass at American Compass, this is really a jarring stat. For every high school student who graduates college and finds a job that leverages her degree, 4 fall short. For every high school student who graduates college and finds a job that leverages her degree, fall for short. They either never enroll in college, they drop out, or graduate and wind up underemployed. About half take on debt they come to regret. So for millennials, college or bust created winners out of about 20% of the country's students and a bust for the rest. How's that for the distribution? And also the increasing stratification, not necessarily by income, because you don't need a college degree to make a lot of money in this country. The stratification between the college degreed and the non-college degreed politically. What has embittered so many millennials, writes Douglas Belkin, and he gives a couple of good examples, is that they played by the rules and still got stuck, right? Because the rules were set up to game you, something that people just can't. No, this is my government. They would never run a scam on me. All they do is run scams on you. All they do. As someone famously said, the state isn't broken, it's fixed. What has embittered so many millennials is they play by the rules and still got stuck. Ben Puckett, a 30-year-old pastor in Michigan, earned a Bachelor of Science in Physical Therapy before a master's degree in Divinity. He's 95 grand in debt. I went to college because I was told by parents, friends, teachers, and counselors that it was the only way to ensure a good future. At 18 years old, how was I supposed to defy what my school, parents, society, friends were saying about going to college? That's changing, though. Between 1979 and 2010, enrollment at 2 and 4 year four-year colleges and universities doubled during that period to 18 million in total. Since then, the last decade, it's fallen by about 2 million. As the number of high school graduates shrinks and the return on investments for graduates flattens. and what is providing alternative, who are providing the alternatives. Companies like Google, Amazon, Microsoft launching programs which certify vocational competence and lead to well-paying tech jobs in or outside their companies. As one professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education noted, the minute you have enough groups from industry or the military or nonprofits validate these things, you provide a way of bypassing educational institutions, the cartel. And that will open up the door to people not having to get a bachelor's degree as a warrant to enter the workplace. And oh, by the way, there's a marketplace for this. According to a 2019 Kaplan survey of 2,000 parents, 74% of American parents favor a pathway for students to go straight from high school to a full-time job while taking college classes. We made a big policy mistake per that pastor who has $95,000 in debt. We made a big policy mistake in pushing college for all. Orrin Cass calling it a catastrophically bad system that has to change. Right. When a college for all is supposed to guarantee a stable middle income or better life for all, and it only delivers for one in five, that's a problem. That's what we call a policy failure. But everybody's so obsessed by the credential. And I'm not just talking about William H. Macy and his wife. Everybody's so obsessed by the credential that they don't pay attention to the bodies strewn in the wake of the rush to prestige universities. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. So now fast forward to Joe Biden and Reparation H, Creepshow Joe and Reparation H in Delaware yesterday. Talking about...
It's hard to watch those, isn't it?
Talking about free college.
Yeah.
Right? Free college is going to be the salvation.
That's Bernie Sanders' idea, which they have to follow because they promised Bernie, give us your supporters... And we'll help you out.
$10,000 in student debt forgiveness.
Okay.
Right? That's the plan. And free, quote unquote, free college for anyone with a household income under 125 grand. What is that doing? It is trying to prop up the college for all system, isn't it? A failure. It's a failed system. What does the left always do? And some on the right, unfortunately, center right. The problem with the system is what? Not that it failed, or the reason that it failed is it's not big enough. If we make it bigger, it'll be better. No, it'll be a bigger failure and a more expensive one. They don't want to rethink. They just want to shovel more money into it, just like they've done K-12 education for the last 50 years. Which is why so many K-12 systems never change. Why would you have to change if you continue to get more and more money for producing lesser results, frankly? There's no incentive to change. There's no incentive to even know, to implement what we know to be true about how kids learn. So it's not done in so many K-12 systems. And it's certainly not done at the collegiate level. So what can you do? You just turn those systems entirely into totalitarian re-education centers to indoctrinate young political activists to radiate out into all of the professions that have cultural and civic import and influence, which is exactly what's happened. And that's how we've gone from where we were 50 years ago to where we are today, in large measure. Bill in LaSalle County, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Bill.
Bill. You there, Bill? I don't think Bill's there.
Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, I don't think of it. I think it's been more than 50 years. And I like to call in, and I love listening to the show. I don't want you to think I'm a crank for this. But I don't know. Crank, congratulate me. I read a book years ago, and it was about the 19th Amendment in 1920. And I'm not blaming all women, but women have a tendency to vote with emotion, and they voted for every bleeding heart that needed help. And so the government went from a fiscally responsible institution to a giveaway program for everything. And because they were pandered to by the politicians at the time and through the decades of, these people need help. These people need help. And then it's devolved now into anybody with their hand out deserves something, not people who are contributing, who have, according to the great Bamster himself, who have skin in the game, get to vote. But no, everybody's going to vote.
And it's all the women's fault, right?
And I'm not saying that. That's not what I said. Don't take me out of context. I said it started there. Okay. And then I said, now with these two idiot morons that are going to be in here, they're going to let all the legal residents and, people who just cross the border and drop a kid, they're going to get to vote and their families are going to get to vote. So this situation's over. And as far as education is concerned, people have known that. And the government's concern, it's the hugest scam ever. It's the hugest pyramid scheme on civilization ever. And that's what it's turned into.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Appreciate it.
I mean, how in a few decades tuition could go from $7,000 to $57,000?
Because the government's involved.
Right.
Because the government subsidizes.
So what do you get? It's a scam.
Well, if you subsidize, you get more of something. So you subsidize it, what do you get?
More.
Increased tuition.
Right.
That's what you're getting more of.
Bigger bills.
By the way, it's worth checking out John Lott's book, Freedomnomics. He tracks the rise of the welfare state and voter participation. It's very interesting. Well, let's hear from Joe Biden. The office of the president-elect. The president-elect has an office, but that's what it said on the marquee behind him. So bizarre.
They're trying to create an office.
This is what he said about his free college program.
Does student loan forgiveness figure in your plan? Would you take executive action to achieve it?
It does figure in my plan. I've laid out in detail. For example, the legislation passed by the Democratic House calls for immediate $10,000 forgiveness of student loans. It's holding people up. They're in real trouble. They're having to make choices between paying their student loan and paying their rent, those kinds of decisions. It should be done immediately. In addition to that, as you know, I think that everything from community college straight through to doubling Pell Grants to making sure that we have access, free education for anyone making under $125,000 for 4 years of college.
Mm-hmm. Jason Furman, who is Obama's former chief economist, he tweeted out, student loan debt forgiveness likely has a multiplier close to zero, in terms of overall positive impact on the economy. Forgiveness is taxable, forgiveness of the loan debt. If this negative cash flow effect outweighs interest, savings would be even net negative, and wealth effect is small in the short run. Arbitrary regressive $1 trillion for zero GDP is not a great idea. That's Jason Furman, Obama's former chief economist. It's a terrible idea. But it's more of the for thee and not for me, or for me and not for thee in this case. For those people who played by the rules and got stuck by the system, sorry, you're not a constituency that's particularly important at this juncture. So they're going to focus on those who are to continue to prop up the scam they're running with College for All culture.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the most important books, as you've heard me say on this show before, the 20th century, is Whitaker Chambers' 1952 autobiography, Witness. Whitaker Chambers, a former Soviet spy who defected to America and converted to Christianity. Chambers described his exit from communism in this manner. What I had been fell for me like dirty rags. The rags that fell for me were not only communism. What fell was the whole web of materialist modern mind, the luminous shroud which it has spun about the spirit of man, paralyzing in the name of rationalism the instinct of his soul for God, denying in the name of knowledge the reality of the soul and its birthright in that mystery on which mere knowledge falters and shatters at every step. If I had rejected only communism, I would have rejected only one political expression of the modern mind, the most logical because the most brutal in enforcing the myth of man's material perfectibility. Modern thought enthrones the autonomy of reason and the autonomy of man. And this is why you see elite opinion repeat itself over and over again throughout history. In his piece in City Journal, Lance Morrow, who is from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, makes this point. For those of you who know history, and I'm not going to delve into it and bore people anymore, but Alger Hiss, the actual Soviet spy, was celebrated in D.C. circles in his time. Whitaker Chambers was considered a dreadful fellow. Yeah. Strange, neurotic ex-communist who wasn't to be trusted. Alger Hiss was part of the in-crowd in the D.C. establishment. During the 30s, in the period when Nazism was rising and the conditions of a Second World War coalesced, fashionable opinion in Great Britain regarded Winston Churchill as a crackpot and an extremist. As Morrow writes, he was a deplorable, it insinuates he was a deplorable of his time. He also writes, at my parents' dinner parties in Georgetown when I was a boy, Eisenhower was written off as an idiot. Couldn't finish a sentence, you know. Read Zane Grey Westerns, played golf with dullard plutocrats. Adlai Stevenson, on the other hand, spoke in elegant paragraphs. Meg Greenfield of the Washington Post recalled in a memoir that when she first arrived in Washington in the 50s, what passed for intelligent cocktail conversation might sound like this. Dulles, oh God, I mean Dulles. How, put Trump where Dulles is at a cocktail party on the North Shore or Hinsdale. And isn't that the argument you hear? I mean, to the extent that you choose to endure such an experience as one of those cocktail parties.
Sounds like you've been to a few.
Trump? Oh, my God. Oh, I mean, Trump? That's an argument. That's the depth.
That's the beginning of a three-hour conversation.
It is? No. That's the depth of their perspicacity. It's the beginning of them rinsing and repeating that one sentence. And that's the point that Morrow makes. If anyone in the world had ever been not our class, dear, it's the ineffable Donald Trump, orange man bad. It takes time to sort out a confrontation as titanic and passionate as the one dividing the country now. But the point, the overriding point that Morrow makes is that the elite just says, let's just put this ugliness behind us. So just to the extent that you think lessons will be learned, for example, Peter Weiner, I mean, apropos of what he argues, and I've argued, frankly, who's a contributor to The Atlantic, also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, interested to talk to Morrow about his colleague, choose repair, not revenge. Let's just put this election behind us. It doesn't matter that the president's efforts to challenge the results of the election are comically inept and he'll be out of office in less than 70 days. My concern is that instead of psychologically moving on from Donald Trump, many of his critics won't let go of him. The end of his presidency has inspired feelings of joy and relief, as you would expect, but it may also perpetrate a cycle of retaliation and bitterness toward the president and those who enabled him. Right. Well, it may. It is.
Jake Tapper said.
Everybody has their lists on the left, as I understand it.
Yeah.
But this choose repair, not revenge. And this is somebody, I guess, Weiner. I guess he's sort of soft center right, I'd say. Never Trump Christian, I suppose. Choose repair, not revenge. Forget this happened. Forget the last 4 years happened. It's going to be over soon. Let's just move on and, again, reestablish our dominance. The thinkers, the betters, the elites, the champagne socialists.
Well, I've got news for them. Trump is never going away. He had 73 million voters that love him, and he's not going away. You think he's going to stop tweeting, guys? You think CNN's going to stop covering him? That's their bread and butter.
We understand that a substantial portion of the country had a bit of a conniption fit. You got Trump for 4 years. We heard you. Now let's just reestablish what we were doing prior to Trump, and we'd like to continue doing.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, or text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. You know, people are talking about, well, Trump's got to go away. And it's only crazy people like Trump supporters that make wild accusations about bad people being in charge. These people aren't bad. Lest we not forget, you're talking about Alger Hiss. What about Kim Philby? I mean, I know he's a Brit, but he was at the very, very top of MI6 for a long, long time. Was friends with James Jesus Angleton, head of the CIA for a while. So, you know, when we talk about these things like we are, about conspiracies at the highest places, if you talk about that, it's crazy until you find out 40 years later that you've been sold out to your enemies by people that you trusted. And I hope that Trump doesn't go away. And I consider Sidney Powell to be a serious person. I heard some of the things that she said recently, and I really hope that serious people like Sidney Powell are able to carry through and conclude the work that she's doing. And by golly, if we need to make sure that Trump is the person who was inaugurated January 20th, then by golly, I hope that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well said, Ralph. And I agree with you. And Sidney Powell, I said similar yesterday. I think she's a serious person. I think she's an accomplished attorney. She is making some big claims. And it's going to be important that those are backed up with the evidence that that she says the legal team is pulling together and presented in for scrutiny in the court of public opinion as well as courts of law. Yes. Joe in St. Charles.
Good morning, Dan, Amy. Love the show. Dan, I wanted to ask you to weigh in on what you thought about Bev Harris' black box voting, some of her claims regarding voting machines and concerns with Diebold, and secondly, how the narrative, much on a lot of the diabolical sins of our society, this narrative is completely controlled. It doesn't seem to be a intellectual discussion. It seems to be pretty controlled and one-sided. I'd be interested in your thoughts. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for the call, Joe. I think those are videos that have been sent to me, but I haven't looked at her claims, so I'll have to get back to you on that. But I agree with you about claims that are being made, particularly when there are claims that have been made against some of the companies that are material in 2020 previously, including by Democrats in Cook County. Sidney Powell made the point that Carolyn Maloney, Democrat rep from Congress, has previously raised issues about some of these companies and their the quality of their product, whether it's voting machines or software platforms. Back in 2006, an election I was involved in, where you had a company called Sequoia was the provider of voting machines in Cook County, Sequoia Voting Systems. And 2006 was a mess, if you remember, both in the primary and in the general election. 2006 was the Cook County Board race between Todd Stroger, Cook County Board President race between Todd Stroger and Tony Parayka. And I was with Parayka, and that was the night that we stormed the Cook County building because there were these
ballot boxes that just showed up, remember?
Well, they weren't transmitting electronically back to world headquarters, and then there was no confidence in the chain of custody. And then so we went down to the Cook County building, and you saw people pulling up with boxes that were unsealed and voting machines and ballots, and it was a mishmash. And it was
I got punched
insane
in the arm that night.
It was
honestly because I was trying to look in the ballot box and it was open, and then somebody swatted my hand away. And my arm, like physically, and I got a bruise on my arm.
It was something crazy.
It was a fight.
It was something like you'd see in a third world country,
yeah,
which persists to this day. Well, if you go back and look, this is after the primary where they had problems. And, of course, the problems weren't corrected for the general. The confusion This is from a April 2006 story in the Chicago Tribune. The confusion in Cook County, particularly from widespread failures in remote reporting of results from polling places, was reported on the front page of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, just as officials in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, were finalizing a $12 million contract with Sequoia. Although different machines were to be used in Pennsylvania, the experience in Chicago and suburban Cook County concerned Allegheny officials enough that they went with another vendor. Also, this company, Smartmatic, which has been mentioned along with Dominion Voting Systems in 2020. This is one of the companies in the crosshairs. Much of the angst about Sequoia is related to its purchase in March 2005 by Smartmatic Corp., a company that provided voting machines for the controversial 2004 recall election of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Sidney Powell has mentioned the fact that Smartmatic and the voting machines in some jurisdictions are Smartmatic voting machines and their history, arguably participating in vote manipulation in third world countries like Venezuela to the benefit of Chavez and subsequently Maduro. This is what Sidney Powell has said. Smartmatic's involvement in U.S. elections troublesome, including, are you ready for it?
What?
Chicago Alderman Ed Burke.
Oh, there you go.
Who has suggested that the company's equipment could be part of a Venezuelan conspiracy to subvert American democracy.
You can't make this stuff up.
So Ed Burke in 2006 was talking about a company we're talking about in 2010. And it was Ed Burke suggesting that the company was potentially part of a conspiracy to undermine American democracy. And yet it's those on the right who are conspiracy theorists. Smartmatic, which provided the election machines for the Venezuelan vote, can rightly claim that they have conducted one of the most closely watched, carefully audited, and statistically analyzed elections in recent history, said Oak Park-based Major Scale Technology Management. That's what they wrote in a memo to Cook County David Orr's office. More than 97% of Smartmatic is privately held, owned by the four founders of the firm, company that in a letter that they sent back to Burke responding to his allegations. Yeah. Got the Oak Park stamp of approval sent to Cook County Clerk David Orr's office back in 2006. Ed Burke.
Wow.
Suggested the company's equipment could be part of a Venezuelan conspiracy to subvert American democracy. Do we remember that history here in Cook County from 14 years ago? Greg and Schomburg.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Before you left for vacation, Dan, I made the point about a lot of the things that are coming true on Dominion right now, and I made this point, that everything can be proven technologically. It doesn't matter who owned things. It's going to matter with log files, whether log files were overwritten, et cetera. And one of the things that's going to be really wonderful, I think, with the level of detail that Sidney Powell's bringing to the equation, is every single human being on planet Earth, except Apple people, have experienced Bill Gates and Microsoft and the continual blue screens of death and, you know, problems. And when they see how it is simple to drag just one folder into the mix of votings and it switches on an auto exec bat basis, they are going to be convinced. It's going to be solved on a technical basis. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Greg. We shall see.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Stephen Hayward over at Powerline Blog asked the question, are Democrats ready to give up on identitarian politics in the wake of a surprising performance by House Republicans, picking up 9 seats, maybe going to as many as 13, including our friend Burgess Owens in Utah, who's,
who's
the winner. That's great.
Yep, because they had him losing, but now he's the winner.
And
good for him.
The answer, at least from Raphael Warnock, who is a Democrat Senate candidate in Georgia, he's the opponent of Kelly Loeffler in that runoff. The answer seems to be no from Raphael Warnock and those that still drive the Democrat Socialist Party into that runoff and perhaps into a Biden administration.
America needs to repent for its worship of whiteness on full display this season. How is it that you can insult everybody? All Muslims, something other than children of God, call Mexicans murderers and rapists, insult the disabled. How is it you can insult everybody, but then one weekend somebody discovers in the recording that you insult those whose daughters and wives look like those who have been supporting you, and then all of a sudden we can't take it anymore. Repent for the worship of whiteness.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Warnock does a heck of a Reverend Jeremiah Wright impersonation, doesn't he? The worship of whiteness, part of the lack of sway that I think identitarian politics has, even as it continues to advance, is it just doesn't stack up to what people see in the real world. The worship of whiteness, is that what's going on? I wonder if people in Appalachia think that their whiteness is being worshipped in this country. And that's the subject, in part, of Kevin Williamson's new book. Kevin Williamson is a correspondent for National Review. His new book, Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dunk Woolly Wilds of the Real America. That's some title. And he joins us now. Kevin, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Morning. So what about Reverend Warnock and the worship of whiteness? Turns out that being white in America doesn't necessarily provide entrance into exclusive clubs.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. You know, what's interesting to me about that is that the Democratic primary gave people on the left a chance to nominate a much more radical candidate than they did. They could have had a socialist like Bernie Sanders. They could have had someone who was really deep into racial politics instead of someone like Joe Biden, who's pretty clumsy on that. But they ended up rallying behind Biden, and that was really led by African-American voters. My read from that is that there's just not nearly as much of a popular mandate for this kind of social radicalism as a lot of people in the Democratic Party seem to think that there is. On the flip side of that, we've seen what my book is about, which is we spent the last 4 years spending a great deal of time talking about the white working class, or more often the white non-working class, rural poverty in places like Appalachia, which I spent a lot of time writing about, and the various social problems like addiction that go along with that. And a lot of this ends up being an example of what I call Williamson's first law of politics, which is that everything is really, really simple if you don't know anything about it. And the book is an attempt to give people some actual information about what's going on in parts of the country that a lot of the media doesn't write about and doesn't cover that much and doesn't know very much about.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit, because it strikes me as a bit of a cross between J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy and Chris Sarnati's Dignity in many respects, although your use of language is much different than theirs. But one of the points that you make that I wanted to explore with you is that you write, in effect, welfare has made Appalachia into a big and sparsely populated housing project. Too backward to thrive, but just comfortable enough to keep the underclass in place.
Yeah, well, there's actually a section about housing projects in Chicago in there that kind of goes along with that argument pretty well. But yes, so what we have in a lot of Appalachia, and the place I've really spent a lot of time writing about, is called Owsley County, which is in eastern Kentucky, and it's the poorest county in America most of the time when the census comes out. And what you see in places like this is that people who have any kind of skills or ambition or education typically leave, and they go some other place and they find jobs and make lives somewhere else, and often not that far away. Sometimes it's one of the larger cities in Kentucky. Sometimes they go other places. But welfare dependency creates a situation economically where you can have a large population of people who are left behind who don't have the really, really pressing economic incentive to do something else. And so you get what I call the sociological salton sea, which is as it gets smaller and smaller, the poisons get more and more concentrated. And so you get these really, really dysfunctional places like Alsea County, where you've got, you know, something like 70% welfare dependency, this whole underground economy based on food stamp fraud, quite a bit of drug addiction and that sort of thing. But on the flip side, very little violent crime, about half of the national average. So it's always a more complicated story once you go in and look at things and start talking to people and figure out what's actually going on.
Yeah, I noted that. And I wanted to get your hand on why you think the violent crime rate is surprisingly low, given, you know, one of the popular myths that persists is poverty equals commission of crimes. And it's not true in black neighborhoods in the cities either. It's a small fraction of people that commit the majority of the violent crimes. But that's the perception.
Yeah, I think that it's not poverty that causes violent crime. I think you need poverty and density and a few other things as well. You know, I wrote a big piece for National Review that's in this book about Chicago and why it has so many murders and trying to figure that out. And there's always, you know, these kind of pat political answers people give themselves that flatter their ideological preferences. But one of the reasons why Chicago has so much sort of street-level homicide is that it undertook a series of very successful organized crime prosecutions a few generations ago. And the thing about organized crime is it's organized. And so whereas once upon a time you had a Chicago drug industry that was controlled by a handful of middle-aged businessmen, essentially, now you've got one that's run by a big dispersed group of teenagers, each one of them, you know, controlling three or four blocks. And you get a lot more friction that way. And so the underlying criminal energy, which comes from the sale and consumption of illegal drugs, didn't go away with the prosecutions when you put away Hoover and Barksdale and Fort and all those guys. The market was still out there. You just ended up having a much more anarchic and dangerous mechanism for serving the market. The same thing with getting rid of the the big housing projects in places like the Pretty Green. This is probably good policy, but it didn't do anything to solve the underlying sociological issues. It just dispersed them throughout the city.
Right.
And so you see the same pattern in Chicago as you do in some places. Like Philadelphia is similar in some ways, although maybe not quite as extreme a problem as Chicago has.
Well, does Philadelphia
end up being really complicated?
Yeah, sorry for interrupting. Does Philadelphia still have the large housing complex and projects that we used to have here? Because we got rid of Robert Taylor Homes and Cabrini Green.
Yeah, Philadelphia does not have a lot of big housing complexes like that. It has a similar problem to Chicago's in the sense that it's a city that has relatively high crime, but basically all of the violent crime happens in a handful of small neighborhoods and doesn't really interact with the rest of the city that much. You know, you could spend a whole month in Philadelphia and never know that this is a very high crime city. The same way you could spend a whole month walking around Chicago and never see anything that looked untoward. You never know that it's a place that has 500 murders a year.
Talk to us about sort of the instances of adverse selection that afflict some of these poor communities that you visited and wrote about.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean by the salt and sea effect. You know, if you've got any kind of ambition, any kind of chance at education, any sort of, you know, skills or even the energy to go out and pursue these things, you end up leaving these communities because there's really nothing there for you. Some of these places are places where there was some kind of economic disaster. You know, there was an industry that everyone depended on, and that industry went away for some reason. That's kind of the case of San Bernardino, California, which I write about. But in a lot of places, in eastern Kentucky is one of these. There wasn't anything like that. There are places that have just sort of always been poor, and as the rest of the world gets wealthier, their poverty looks more dramatic in comparison. But so long as you have this group of people who are left behind, their problems stay there, and the people who leave take the social capital connections with them as they go. It's a very different thing to be a poor person in a poor community than it is to be a poor person in a fairly well-off community. You know, I grew up in a very poor family, but I grew up in a college town. So most of my friends, their parents were professional. They were college professors. They were doctors. There were things like that. And so I could kind of benefit from their social capital, learn about things like how do you go to college? How do you apply for financial aid? That sort of thing. But if you're in a community where you don't have anyone like that, where you've never known anybody who went to college, anybody who has a good job, where this sort of dependency and dysfunction and despair is just how life is lived, then, you know, especially if you're young, if you're 15, 16 years old, you don't have the knowledge or the social imagination to really think about what your life could look like and then what steps you would have to take to get to that life. And that's a real problem for places, especially isolated rural places that don't have a lot of connections to the broader community.
Social capital, that's such an important phrase, an important aspect of this that's under discussed. We only talk about dealing with poverty from a straight-up capital perspective. How much more benefits are we going to provide, and in what form are they going to take, and so forth. And it seems to me that some of these poor white areas, or big white ghettos, as you call them, may be an opportunity to rethink welfare state policies more generally, because you take the race issue out of the equation and you just talk about incentives and you talk about issues like social capital that persist perhaps in a different way, but are also relevant in urban neighborhoods that are decaying as well. And maybe this is where we can have discussions we need to have about poverty in America more generally that we can apply regardless of race, because it's not so much about race, it's about incentive and environment.
Yeah, the race issue is, I think, again, the complexity of it is underappreciated, because the social and cultural differences in different communities around the country have to do with a lot more than race. And you can see this in that African-American communities in Tennessee are not very much like Baltimore or Detroit. They're different places. They're distinct places who have their own, you know, local ways of doing things, their own local problems, and their own local approaches to things. And it is, I think, helpful to talk about situations of rural America, simply because a lot of people, unfortunately or fortunately, they tend to pay attention to the problems of white people, frankly, more than they do the problems of people who aren't white. I think that a lot of the people who are the policymakers have just sort of developed the assumption for years and years and years that black and Latino neighborhoods, particularly in cities, are just going to be dysfunctional, and that's just it. And we just accept that schools are going to be terrible in Milwaukee, and we accept that schools are going to be terrible in Philadelphia, and we accept that there's going to be tremendously high rates of violent crime in these places. And I think that is that's a mistake. And if it takes, highlighting problems outside of those communities to get people to understand the commonalities, then I think maybe that's a useful thing to do.
Yeah. And conversely, though, I would challenge that just in this way. White people problems, the missing white girl versus the missing black girl. There's something there. But when it comes to things like schools, I mean, the school choice movement, which, of course, is driven by conservatives, that is mainly about providing opportunities for poor Latino and black kids in urban centers. There's not a lot of – I mean, it certainly includes the poor white families in places like Appalachia. But I mean, the focus of the conversation is about, what's happening to black and brown families in New York and L.A. and Chicago.
Yeah, and in fact, it's a lot more for those communities, simply because if you're in a poor rural community, the next high school might be 75 miles away, and school choice isn't really much of a practical benefit for you. Whereas if you're in Boston or Chicago or Los Angeles, there are actually some pretty good schools around that you might want to send your kids to. So it's not as if people never pay attention to those things. I didn't mean to imply that at all. I think the way things resonate with people culturally is tied up in who they are. You know, as I often point out, the policymaking conversation is dominated by people who are, for lack of a better term, elites, reasonably well-off, right, college-educated people. And the conversation necessarily reflects their biases and interests, which is why we spend so much time talking about, well, can Harvard practice affirmative action in its admissions processes, as though who gets into Harvard is really the defining social issue of poverty in America. It's not. But we spend a lot of time talking about college admissions and a lot less time talking about the high school dropout rate in Milwaukee or Baltimore.
The reason I like your book, much like the other books I mentioned that cover this in different ways, is because it's empathetic, but it's not a pity party. I mean, there's no pandering. It's trying to, have real conversations with real people and get real perspective. Like you said, trying to understand issues that are a little bit more complex as you go from community to community than you might understand from just looking at it on the outside. And I assume that the people you spoke with, that resonated too. I mean, that being treated with respect and hearing people out is something that maybe some of those folks don't enjoy too often.
Yeah, it's good to listen to people, and people like talking about their lives. I actually try to keep the sympathy out of the book as much as possible and focus more on accuracy. I often think sympathy and attempts to be empathetic, which is kind of a dumb word, but it's one we use, I think they actually get in the way of good journalism a lot of the times, because it makes the journalist think more about how he presents himself to the reader and to the public as this, compassionate, semi-heroic figure. rather than just, you know, telling the story that needs to be told. So maybe there's some sympathetic stuff in there, but I've tried to keep it to a minimum.
All right. Not a Hero, Kevin Williamson, roving correspondent for National Review. The book, Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dank Woolly Wilds of the Real America. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much.
And he joined us on our turnkey.proanswer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've got lockdown policies all over the nation. Round two, at minimum. Michigan shut down for 3 weeks. Illinois is trending that way. California, the same.
You know the difference in Michigan, though? Governor Whitner shut down casinos, which we can't do here because 30% of the revenue goes to the state. So we need that money, man.
We can do it, and we still might. I wouldn't tempt fate. Teachers' unions are around the country leading the fight to keep schools closed, lockdown, safety.
Yeah. Illinois Teachers' Union this morning calling for Pritzker to close all buildings because it's not safe because there's an increase, a surge in COVID cases.
Experts.
Yeah.
A new study by the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in cooperation with the Naval Medical Research Center published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Are you ready? I wish those men and women of science who are sharing a single brainwave would listen to this and also react to the study, all those credentialed experts who we're supposed to just do as we're told by them, according to Dr. Tony Fauci. The study used 1,843 Marine volunteers. The quarantine took place at a Marine facility under the supervision of the military. So those factors, the fact that Marines are pretty good at following orders, it took place in a Marine facility under the supervision of the military, meant that volunteers probably going to follow procedures much more closely and correctly than the general public.
Exactly.
No one could enter the study without undergoing 14 days of quarantine beforehand, plus a test to prove they were negative at the study start.
Okay.
The study itself was held in a tightly controlled quarantine campus run by the Marines. The volunteers had to follow this incredibly strict quarantine regimen. All recruits wore double layered cloth masks at all times, indoors and outdoors, except when sleeping or eating, practice social distancing of at least 6 feet, were not allowed to leave campus, did not have access to personal electronics and other items that might contribute to surface transmission, and routinely washed their hands. They slept in double occupancy rooms with sinks, ate in shared dining facilities, and used shared bathrooms. All recruits cleaned their rooms daily, sanitized bathrooms after each use with bleach wipes, and ate pre-plated meals in a dining hall that was cleaned with bleach after each platoon had eaten. Most instruction and exercises were conducted outdoors. All movement of recruits was supervised, and unidirectional flow was implemented with designated building entry and exit points to minimize contact among persons. All recruits, regardless of participation in the study, underwent daily temperature and symptom screening. Six instructors assigned to each platoon worked in 8-hour shifts and enforced the quarantine measures. If recruits reported any signs or symptoms consistent with COVID-19, they reported to the sick call, underwent rapid PCR testing, and were placed in isolation pending the results of the test.
And what happened?
Instructors were also restricted to campus, were required to wear masks, were provided with pre-plated meals, underwent daily temperature checks and symptom screening. Instructors were assigned to a platoon in which a positive case was diagnosed, underwent PCR testing, and if the result was positive, removed from duty. Do you think anything like that is actually occurring in the real world? Anything like that with these lockdown policies? Anything approximating that?
No.
The result?
What?
The
Keeping
virus.
My fingers crossed.
The virus spread through the population.
Oh boy.
Epidemiological analysis supported multiple local transmission events, including transmission between roommates and among recruits within the same platoon. None of the strict lockdown mandates, including continuous mask use, did anything to prevent transmission. The control group of Marines who did not participate in the study and thus were not under the same strict lockdown rules actually saw fewer infections.
Oh.
the difference wasn't very large, but it exists. And nonetheless, one could argue the overuse of masks perhaps contributed to the higher numbers in the study group, since even in this tightly controlled setting, it is still impossible to expect people to wear masks properly.
And you're touching your face more.
Huh. So Marines who were not quarantined, not locked down, not following all these protocols, the control group, did not participate in the study. Fewer infections than the Marines who lived like I just described for the purposes of this study. Maybe put that question to Governor Jelly Belly and Mayor Triple Threat and ask them, you know, as men and women of science they are and data, ask them to respond to this New England Journal of Medicine study. Bring it to them so they can't pretend that they haven't seen it. Here it is. How do you react to this? Have Arwadi and Ezekiel and everybody else under the sun of the lockdown and bus variety, all the way up to Tony Fauci, read and react. I'd be interested to hear. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I'm just reporting what the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York, along with the Naval Medical Research Center, reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. Is that enough credentials for you? Mike in Yorkville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, I was just having a conversation with my buddy the other day, and he was just asking, he said, why do people have such a difficult time trusting, especially the doctors in the situation, or experts, so-called experts? And my knee-jerk reaction, I said, because they sell out their credentials and their profession to a political ideology.
Yeah, that's about right. That's a nice, succinct answer for your friend, because that's exactly what's happened. Thanks for the call, Mike. That's exactly what's happened. Why do they have such little credibility now? Is because they've destroyed it, so many of them, over the last 8 months. Not just by what they've said that turned out to be wrong, but by eliminating or acting in furtherance of attempting to eliminate dissent. Suggesting that renowned epidemiologists who have all the credentials that they have, the ones that you see on Meet the Press and popularized by the D.C. press corps, Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford and Sunetra Gupta at Oxford and Kulldorff at Harvard. It could go on. You know, there's only 20,000 some odd that signed the Great Barrington Declaration. Those individuals, John Ioannidis at Stanford, were there to be dismissed. They have the same expertise. They have the same qualifications. We've never done this before, locking down healthy people, so you think you may want robust discussion about it, particularly as the evidence continues to roll in. And the lack of evidence continues to be lacking for the policies we're actually pursuing. You might think you'd want to retrench your position, as the position has been retrenched on so many topics, hasn't it? From testing to mask wearing to locking down to schools.
Sitting down and watching Rome burn. I mean, no one's doing it. If the governor, because he does have, he is controlling us here, folks. If he would just admit, you know what, this, what we're doing right now, it's not working. We're going to take a different approach. Maybe get a new set of eyes on this. Maybe bring some men in. Okay, I'm all for promoting my own gender, but he surrounds himself with women.
With men and women.
Dan, they're crying sometimes. And I cry too. But, you know, you're supposed to be leading and.
Okay.
They have emotional moments.
I'd be happy if he brought Dr. Sunetra Gupta in, who's a woman from Oxford.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with gender. It has everything to do with expertise and independent thinking and a sober analysis of the evidence.
Well, that's why we need a new set of eyes on this. What we're doing is not working.
Mike in Crown Point.
Good morning, guys. Scientific methods being totally ignored this whole process. It's all a bunch of correlation thinking. They look at one chart compared to another chart. Oh, there's a correlation between them. It must be causality. It's nonsense. We can put everybody in mason jars with life support systems for a month, and you take them out, they're still going to get sick.
That's next.
It has to run its course.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mike. That's next is the mason jar treatment. Joe Biden yesterday at his presser with Reparation H talking about this, reacting to Scott Atlas suggesting that the draconian lockdowns reinstituted in Michigan by the Eva Perón of East Lansing should be resisted.
President's now existing, remaining
advisor on COVID is saying that they should resist. What the hell's the matter with these guys? What is the matter with them? Resist. You know, every major individual of any consequence in the health field is saying we can save, 100,000 lives. Just be-
no, they're not. It's a lie. But I know Joe Biden is used to fabulism and lying. And by the way, come on, man, is not an argument. Certainly not a scientific one.
Oh, and then another reporter, by the way, they choose the reporters every day and have to look at the questions first before they're asked, talked about, you know, this smooth transition during a pandemic.
What do you see as the biggest threat to your transition right now, given President Trump's unprecedented attempt to obstruct and delay a smooth transfer of power?
More people may die.
Of course.
Yeah. If we don't coordinate. If we have to wait until January 20th to start that planning, it puts us behind over a month, month and a half.
Yeah.
We're losing lives.
If their reporters had firing synapses, they would say, exactly what? So it starts right now. What are the plans that you are prepared to effect when given the green light? Maybe we could start right now. President Trump would give you the reins to say, okay, go ahead, Joe, institute your plan. What are the particulars? National mask mandate, national lockdown. What are the particulars? Oh, by the way, there are members of your advisory committee, not that anybody, your transition committee, not that anybody pays attention to this. They just elevate what Osterholm from University of Minnesota said over the weekend about a 4 to 6 week lockdown. There are other people on Biden's transition team that disagree with Osterholm and disagree with 75 and out Zeke Emanuel. But of course, you know, anybody who does not adhere to the bien pensant is eliminated from consideration. It's the most remarkable thing. Tell me again about science and data, but nobody puts it between the eyes of these people. Nobody. And part of it is because, of course, they won't submit themselves to scrutiny. And the other part of it is because the press corps is in the tank. And the other part of it is because even some on the center right who get access aren't very good. They're just not good at making arguments or prosecuting arguments, are they? It's the most frustrating thing as the evidence continues to pile up. Carl in Prospect Heights.
Amy, I hope you continue to go at Pritzker in these press conferences. And I just want to say he's obviously corrupted, and he's not listening to the right, quote-unquote, science. But mainly, he is just a coward. He's scared of everybody dying on his watch, and he thinks he's going to be blamed for it. I think that's really what drives him.
Yeah. I mean, if you can just sit there and watch him process the thought, oh, shoot, I can't go away for Thanksgiving because I'm supposed to stay here to file the guidance that I set in place for others. It's embarrassing. I feel bad for him. I went from hatred.
Why? Why do you feel bad for him?
He's in way over his head.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't. He's not capable of doing this job anymore.
Oh, I have often had friends, many friends who don't live.
Oh, that's not the right.
Since you live in Chicago, I mean, are you going to follow the no travel advisory that Mayor Lightfoot put into place at 6 a.m. this morning?
Yeah, I don't know what that says exactly, and I don't know exactly what my plans will be, but I'll certainly, you know, be happy to share.
Second City Blog said that your family's already in Florida and all.
Well, I think you already know. I mean, we have a place in Florida, so.
Yeah, and we're not going to address rumors from random blogs online. So we will do. We're going online.
Must know what the mayor's plan is. I mean,
I actually have not seen what the mayor put out this morning. I've been very busy, as you can imagine.
We
are.
She put it out last week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. There was something new this morning.
It's pathetic. It's sad, doesn't that? I mean, this is a person who's governing us, who's destroying our livelihoods, closing restaurants, no in-person dining, not letting our kids go back to school. It's ridiculous. Or play sports.
Mike in Oak Forest.
Good morning, folks. I noticed that I must have put gasoline in my car hundreds of times in the last year, and I've noticed like four people that use gloves handling the pump handle. it's used 1,000 times a day.
Yeah.
It's one little thing.
Right. Thanks for the call. I mean, is there any evidence to support surface transmission? I think that was suggested there is virtually no basis to suggest that it transfers via surface. I think that's been what we understand for 7 months.
Yeah, but at first they said, oh, it's on the boxes that you get from Amazon. You have to Clorox wipe them down. I mean, this has been such kabuki theater.
So we advanced our understanding of the transmission 7 months ago, and yet we're still arguing about surface transmission. And it's fine. Continue to study it, as this Icahn School of Medicine study included with their Marines. Fine. And it, you continue to test it and study it and you to find the same results. And then the behavior doesn't change. But it's not political. This isn't sort of for thrill-seeking secular humanists. That's not what this is about. This is about saving lives and science and data. Sure it is. Chuck in his car.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy. I was drafted into the Marine Corps, as I'm showing my age, in 1966. Actually, I got my greetings on Christmas Eve to go into the Army, and they changed it to the Marines because Vietnam was heating up. And we had in a San Diego boot camp, we had two Marines come down with spinal meningitis. And what they did was they actually had us, platoon was 84 guys, and we're 19-year-olds. And they had us to be the last platoon going into the mess hall. After that, they scrubbed it down, bleached it, you know, whatever they did. I don't recall them wearing any mask or washing our hands and being, what do you want to call it, schizophrenic about it. But it's just... you know, it's crazy. I mean, these people don't know what they're doing. That's what it is. I mean, the Marines do know what they're doing. I remember Rush Limbaugh saying something about, you can wear a pack in 95 degree weather. The Marines were ahead of the game. They never ran us. They always marched us when it got real hot. So the Marines know what they're doing.
Right.
And these people that are running the government don't. You know, I mean, not except the, exception of, Trump. But I'm talking about these, mayors like Lightfoot and Pritzker, they don't have an idea in their head, as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. Appreciate it. Steve in Evanston.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Trudeau just came out and outright said it. This is a great opportunity for them to reset. I love that they're using the word reset now.
By the way, I mean, for people... We're paying attention.
Yeah.
Gavin Newsom said the same thing 6 months ago. We played it on this show.
What?
I mean, they are out in the open. That's the one thing they are transparent about. You just have to pay attention to what they're actually saying. So, yeah, that's right. Trudeau said it. We don't need Trudeau's guidance. We have governors like Newsom and Pritzker and Whitmer and Cuomo who are out and proud about doing that. Opportunity to transform. Absolutely.
And what did Rahm Emanuel say about
never let a good crisis go to waste? Right, yeah. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Or that.
John in Waukegan.
Yeah, I was at Fort Gordon, Georgia in the fall of 66, and we had the same thing. Spinal meningitis went through that camp. What we did at night is we left the top of the window open and the bottom, and we took our ponchos and strung those between the bunks. They call them sneeze sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our barracks, I don't remember anybody getting hit, but it went through the camp. I don't know where it came from or whatever. And then there was some point in history, they had it down there at one of the Illinois colleges some years ago, too.
Yeah.
Spinal meningitis
outbreak. Yeah, it can happen on college campuses, sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, John. I think it was at U of I. Right, but the Marines just rub some dirt on it and carry on. I get it. Grant in Rockford.
Good morning, you two. Real quick, Amy, Pritzker doesn't deserve our pity. He deserves torch and pitchforks. But anyway, you already missed Trump. He was positive. It probably wasn't for the people who didn't like him. But you hear Biden talking long, dark winter and all these foreboding things. They just beat you down in the dirt and make you feel helpless. And it's just, I know that's their goal, but it's just a disheartening, horrible feeling.
Yeah.
There's no hope.
You know, you should do, everybody should, if you watch Governor Pritzker's press conferences, try watching Governor Herbert from Utah or Holcomb from Indiana. It's not doom and gloom. It's like, these are the facts, and they don't bring in doctors to push their own narratives about, you know, sports are bad, and here's why, because this doctor says so. They just give you the facts. They don't make you feel like you want to go hang yourself or slit your wrists at the end.
Meanwhile, you know, keep calm and pass the ammo, Dan. Have a good one.
All right, thanks, Grant. Chuck in Lamont.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out when we're going to ask Governor Pritzker real science questions based upon the different age groups and the severity of their cases. Or what I should say is, the groups that are not at risk, when are we going to start coming up with protocols for those people? Real science questions based upon real facts, based upon real age groups, based upon really what's going on the ground.
Thanks,
when
Chuck.
You challenge him on science, when you challenge him on science, he won't have an answer.
Thanks, Chuck. Yeah, that requires a Chicago press corps we don't have, I'm afraid.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Brown girl, what do you feel? Reads the teacher. That black girl magic will help us all heal, recite the children. Stanley Eugene Clark Public School in Brooklyn, New York, where a poetic rendition is dedicated to Senator Kamala Harris, who even elementary school children know, waiting in the wings to become the vice president of the United States.
First female vice president.
Thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
The poem is an update of Leslie Honoré's poem, Brown Girl, which she originally wrote in 2016 for her book of poetry. I'm sure you have it. So it's so interesting, the Dear Leader serenades that are advanced by teachers in taxpayer-funded public school settings. Do you remember this one from elementary students at Burlington, New Jersey, at a Burlington, New Jersey public school for Dear Leader Obama? Wearing Obama Hope t-shirts.
I'm sure there's...
Well,
I'm sure they did one for Trump. Yeah, Orange Man Bad. I can just hear how that one went.
The point should be that if any politician saw a teacher instructing children in that way, they should be offended and put an immediate end to it. That is Chinese communist quality propagandizing. Public schools. Happening with Obama. It happened with Hillary Clinton, even though she was never elected. And it's happening now with Biden and Kamala Harris. Uh-huh. And so how do we get to this place, you're asking yourselves?
What happened?
Right. It just started under Trump, hardly.
Mm-hmm. You've been warning us for decades.
Hardly. And the implications from pre-K through post-secondary education, as the walls close in on our individual rights. And I don't think that's overstating the case at all. Just ask Abigail Schreier. She's the author of a book on identitarian politics, specifically trans movement. Irreversible Damage is the name of her book, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. The deputy director of trans studies at the ACLU has suggested that her book not be distributed. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And, of course, all of the your fungible academics, universities across the country saying the same thing. ACLU is not going to defend unpopular opinions, even though that's basically their charter. Nope. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, and author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Eric, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be here, Dan.
You have done an interesting study. You wrote about academic freedom and cancel culture. And I think it's a little bit more serious than cancel culture. I mean, I think this is a purge. And by the way, it's not just Twitter and Facebook. Conservative Treehouse, which is a popular conservative blog, was deplatformed by WordPress, the website hosting platform. We've talked before about what MailChimp is doing to blacklist conservative groups. This is deplatforming conservative groups from the digital space, not just your Facebook or Twitter account. But to your study, Eric, about the culture on campus, you looked at a study of 820 British academics who run the largest and most representative sample of academic opinion and free expression to date. YouGov maintained a panel of about 500,000 respondents, including some 1,000 current or retired academics who completed the survey. And what does that survey tell us?
Yeah, well, basically, a couple of things jump out, because often people will claim that, a lot of the criticism of universities isn't based in data, or that the data is skewed. But this is pretty rigorous, as you're going to get. And one of the key findings was that one in three academics would discriminate against a known supporter of the leave side, that is, to leave the European Union. So if they knew somebody was a supporter of that position, which was voted for by about 52% of the British population, they wouldn't hire an individual. So we've got some pretty good evidence of political discrimination. And on a similar survey in the U.S., around 40% of academics polled said they wouldn't hire a known Trump supporter. So these are just pretty powerful indicators of the kind of discrimination that then leads to the loss of political diversity on campus in the professoriate. And then, of course, the knock-on effect of that is people then become very hesitant to express their political views to colleagues, and that then affects also the subjects they study. So there's this real issue of self-censorship. It's as distinct from, direct censorship. There's also, I think, something much more pervasive, which is self-censorship, because you fear the consequences if your political views become known.
Well, then how do you change the culture on campus? Is it even possible? I mean, you have to have some sort of fifth column action with a plucky band of insurgents, it would seem to me, in the Ivy League and elsewhere, in order to accomplish anything. Otherwise, they're just picking professors off one at a time as needed, or shutting those down, like you say, through a culture that encourages self-censorship. And as they're continuing to do the hiring and vetting people for their political views, well, they're just shrinking the diversity of opinion on campus to the point where it'll be non-existent.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've seen already, say, between the 1990s and the 2010s, the share of conservatives in American academia is down to about 10%. From about 20%, and the share of on the left is about 60% compared to the center. So the centrists have actually gone down in the left. The conservatives were already pretty low. The centrists have gone down, and the left has gone up to 60%. Now, in Britain, I mean, one of the things I argue for is that really only government action is going to be able to address this. I mean, we saw in the U.S. case with the Trump executive order on critical race theory, or the Title IX removals. Those are kind of the kind of actions that would be needed. Here in Britain, what we recommended was something called we need to create something called the Director of Academic Freedom on the university's regulator here, who would So if somebody felt that their academic freedom was violated on campus, they could go around their universities and appeal directly to this individual and therefore get around the kind of kangaroo courts and the sort of disciplinary apparatus of the universities, which are heavily politically skewed in many cases. And just that, just knowing that you'd have recourse to something other than your university, I think would give a lot of academics at least some bravery to sort of begin to speak their mind a bit more freely, not worry about losing out on not just getting a job, well, not just being fired, but not being, for example, not being hired, not being given a grant, not being promoted, etc. It's those other things which are actually much more important. And so just having that kind of regulatory framework in place, I think would go some way. And it's not going to cure the problem of the sort of 9 or 10 to 1 left to right ratio, but it will at least make people freer to be able to speak their minds.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's just more realistic step than what I'm about to propose, but it would seem to me that that they're nothing short of removing funding, whether it is state sponsored funding or it is alumni funding, will get their attention.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic, but my worry is that that is still going to leave in place a fundamentally skewed setup. I mean, I'm coming around to the view that a more intrusive government regulation, so in Britain, requiring universities to submit every year a record of all the disciplinary actions they've taken around free speech, and if they have effectively violated the law, to be fined. So effectively you're getting compliance through that kind of regulatory process. I just don't think this idea of good ideas driving out bad or new universities popping up that are committed to free speech driving out the old ones is going to work, because it's a bit like Google or Facebook or Twitter. You know, these things are so big and they've got network advantages that there's no way they're going to be replaced. So I think you really do need to get in and start regulating the content. I don't think we can actually cut our way out of this problem. I think you've actually got to get people scrutinizing what the universities are doing in detail and holding their feet to the fire each year.
Yeah, but the concern there is you're going from the frying pan to the fire. You're going from college commissars regulating content to government commissars.
True, but I guess the it's like the Supreme Court, where, you know, if you imagine a Supreme Court had a particular ideological agenda, you know, it's better in some ways to have it be politicized and to have the process transparent, and at least people can vote and parties can campaign on the Supreme Court. And similarly, I think you can hold governments to account if you don't like what they're doing on regulation of universities, whereas if you have a hands-off approach, then essentially you're leaving it to these social justice pressure groups and, you know, diversity administrators and others, HR people, to more or less control the process. So it's one of these ones where the hands-off deregulation approach is actually the worst one, because it more or less just gives an open field for the what I call left modernist pressure group network to more or less control and capture these institutions. So here's an odd situation where actually governments are needed in order to improve freedom. Another example of that would be in the some of the public schools here in Britain that are majority Muslim, where sort of an Islamist clique came into control of the school. The government had to step in and actually take control away from them and put them under special measures. Again, I think something very similar is needed in this situation, where you've got a clique or a network that's gained control, like a mafia that's gained control of the institution, and you need to have that democratic government with a mandate come in and actually more or less step in order to preserve people's freedom.
Eric, shifting gears to the election, you wrote an article about who are the real shy Trumpers. 45% of Republicans with degrees compared to 23% of Democrats with degrees said they feared that their careers could be at risk if their views became known. How does this affect polling? Because they all got it wrong. I mean, this blue wave did not happen.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you notice in the exit poll was how off the polls were for college-educated whites. I mean, this is something we don't really hear much about. It's always about the white working class without degrees. Actually, if you really look at the polls, the biggest polling errors, if you compare pre and post was with white college educated voters. And this is also the group that has the biggest majority saying that they're afraid that if their political views became known, their careers could be adversely affected or even be fired. That's coming from a Cato study recently. And so, you know, we can look at this two ways. I mean, if you look at, you can either think of it in terms of people not wanting to answer the phone when a pollster calls up, maybe because they don't want to reveal their views, or you can also think of it in terms of a sort of reaction against political correctness that people are resentful of media, anything associated with media or academia. And it's that reactance that's coming out in terms of these polls. So Frank Luntz, for example, the Republican pollster, reported that over twice as many Republicans said they didn't share their voting intentions with friends. He reported a lot of resentment coming from people who were called up and asked to provide their intention to vote. So you're getting more of this blowback from this segment of the population, which corresponds pretty closely with the group that feels that it is most repressed in terms of what opinions it's allowed to express. And so I think we need a lot more attention then on this kind of conservative white college group. And they haven't had a lot of attention because the dominant narrative is, oh, well, they're all becoming liberal and democratic, and it's really only those uneducated people. But actually, that's not really the case. Moreover, if you actually look at survey data, what you see is education doesn't tell you a great deal about somebody's whether they're going to vote for say, Trump or for Biden. It's much more about attitudes like, you know, attitudes to immigration, to political correctness, and so on. And that varies a hell of a lot within the population of university graduates. And so you really need to get into that to explain who was missed. And I think that's being recognized now. I think there was a piece, I think David Shore in Vox was saying, or I don't know if it was David Shore, he was being interviewed, and he said, you know, we're getting the right mix of educated and not educated, but we're not getting the proper mix of people who trust and don't trust the media. We're getting too many people who trust the media in these polls, and that's skewing them.
Hmm. Well, in the meantime, until those ills are cured, me and the other Winston Smiths will just continue dutifully reciting under the spreading chestnut tree, Eric. But we appreciate your efforts. Eric Hoffman, professor of politics, Birkbeck College, University of London, and author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Illinois Governor Jelly Belly Pritzker doesn't know where he'll be for Thanksgiving, but he knows all the fixins will be there for him when he arrives, wherever that may be. Gavin Newsom doesn't know what's going to happen to K-12 education in California quite yet.
Oh, but Gavin Newsom, another rules for thee, but not for me. He and his wife and a bunch of other people went to a 50th birthday party for one of his political advisors. I thought we were only supposed to have, you know, three separate households. They had multiple family units at this party.
Also, his children returned to in-person learning under a phased-in approach at private schools where his four children attend, even though most of the schools in Sacramento County, where he lives, are shut down, as we see teachers' unions continuing to drive the train with respect to lockdown policies for schools, and now Democrat socialist governors driving lockdown policies in the wake of case spikes around the country. The right policy, supported by the science and the data. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Kevin Pham. Again, he is a medical doctor, a real doctor, contributor to the Daily Signal, former graduate fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me back.
So I mentioned the study earlier in the show. I mentioned to you for reaction This is a study from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York in cooperation with the Naval Medical Research Center. 1,843 Marine volunteers, U.S. Marines, volunteered to be quarantined and follow more stringent procedures with more stringent oversight than the most authoritarian governor or mayor in this country could even imagine. And the results, comparing the experimental group with the control group, which was not, of course, subject to the lockdown policies, the control group of Marines actually saw fewer infections than their experimental group colleagues. The difference wasn't large, but still a difference. So one could argue that perhaps it was the overuse of masks, which were continually used in the experimental group, that contributed to slightly increased transmission because of, you know, not wearing the masks properly and they're not being cleaned properly and so on and so forth. The upshot is strict lockdown mandates, including continuous mask use and oversight of all of the above, accomplished nothing in this study that has yet to be highlighted, even though it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. How do you react?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the government impositions on us during all this time, which would be mirrored by these Marines being strictly monitored, a lot of these impositions, they don't have a larger impact on us than our own personal behaviors. So the control group, they were able to go out in their daily lives as normal, and they were probably not just going out to parties, drinking beers with random strangers and stuff like that. They were probably assessing the risk and then trying to mitigate it on their own. And then so, I'd have to take a look at the results, look at the statistical differences and, mm-hmm. and all of that. But and what it sounds like to me is that, yeah, it's going to be the individual's personal behavior that's going to have the greatest impact on whether a transmission occurs or not.
And what about masks wearing? I mean, in that study, they wore not one mask, but two cloth masks. And also the CDC came out with a study last month that said of the people in America that have gotten COVID, which is 11 million plus, 80% said they wore masks. 70.1% said that they wore them religiously when they would go outside, even if they weren't around other people. And it's still not working.
All right. Well, the masks have marginal protectiveness for the mask wearer. As I'm sure you've heard plenty of times, the mask is about, in the case of COVID, is to protect other people from asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic infected persons. I wouldn't overinterpret that result from the CDC. People tend to wear mask wearing increases with increased community infection rates. So you would expect people who are in an area with a lot of COVID going around, they would probably wear more masks. And so more people who get infected are probably going to be wearing masks. So I wouldn't overinterpret that result, but they are. This does show that masks are not a panacea. They're not perfect protection.
Help us not overinterpret the comments from Joe Biden yesterday about mask wearing when he said this.
President's now existing, remaining advisor on COVID is saying that they should resist. What the hell's the matter with these guys? What is the matter with them? Resist. You know, every major individual of any consequence in the health field is saying we can save 100,000 lives just between now and January 21st by wearing these masks.
Is that right?
Okay. So, no, the vice president has been extremely, extremely unhelpful during all of this. He put out this big viral tweet that said, don't make masks political. Donald Trump makes masks political. And that
the irony was lost on him. Yeah.
Oh, many things are lost on that guy. But no, this is incorrect on every single level. First off, you know, masks are not a panacea. Masks will not save us from this. There was a recent YouGov poll that found that there is 95% of people are wearing masks, some, most, or all of the time, which means that there's 95% at least acceptance of wearing masks. And even so, we're seeing a skyrocketing number of cases. So masks aren't going to prevent the increased case because people are already wearing them. That's the one thing. The other thing is that hundreds of thousands of lives that will be saved from wearing masks. That's not true because of what I had just said, but also because those are based on erroneous numbers. Those are based on an assumption of mask wearing that was taken from early in the pandemic, I think March or April, where mask usage was very low nationally, and it was not very high even in New York and Seattle. So if there was a national mask mandate and if there was 100% compliance with this mask mandate, which there will not be, then you're not going to save 100,000 people because people are already wearing masks, and we're seeing that it's not having the effect that they claim that it does.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the vaccines that are in process, one from Pfizer, one from Moderna. Of course, the market reacting yesterday to the good news about the apparent efficacy of the Moderna vaccine that's still in trial. I talked to Dr. Henry Miller, who's the founder of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology and now at the Pacific Research Institute. One of the points that he made about Pfizer that I hadn't heard anywhere else, but this is what you'd expect from experts in the field, actual value-added information. That's just shocking to me because we're so rarely getting it from the television doctors. But Dr. Miller said there's a problem with the Pfizer vaccine, potentially. Not that it's not 90% effective, and that's great. The problem is the vaccine needs to be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you're going to have a logistical issue in terms of quick and mass distribution with that temperature requirement for storage. And that's something to be considered. So, you know, there's one thing to say, we have a vaccine and the FDA approves it. But then you still have to stand up all of the transportation infrastructure to transport, you know, where we're talking about millions and millions of doses, whether it's the Pfizer product or the Moderna product or some combination of the two. And I don't know the particular qualities of the Moderna vaccine, if there's something similar in terms of how it needs to be transported. But that's a real, like, maybe wonky, but material issue in mass distribution that informs how quickly mass distribution could happen, which informs the sort of public policies we should be accepting when it comes to things like locking down.
Yeah, certainly. And the Moderna vaccine does not require as cold of storage. It requires a more normal temperature, which is a normal refrigerator. But on that front, the Pfizer has been purchasing special refrigerator units for these, and they're running a pilot distribution program to test out their distribution infrastructure before they actually roll out the entire program.
That's good.
So hopefully they'll have everything ironed out by the time an approval comes down the line, or at least an authorization. And hopefully it'll roll out relatively smoothly. There's going to be hiccups. This is a really unprecedented move, trying to vaccinate a lot of people. But this is a good thing that we're going to have two different vaccines. One of the bigger differences is that Pfizer is doing a lot of the contracting on its own, whereas Moderna is primarily relying on the government contracts, the McKesson Logistical Distribution Network. And so that might affect where the majority of these vaccines go.
Ideally, and I don't know, you tell me if this is underway, but ideally, right, I my understanding is Pfizer did not take Operation Warp Speed money. And of course, as you were just suggesting, Moderna did. But I wonder if there'll be some synchronization then, too, if there's a government priorities that may slightly differ from the Pfizer priorities, and that they'll use, sort of operate collaboratively to get as wide a distribution as possible.
I believe so. And just a quick nuance to that, a little caveat. Pfizer did take Warp Speed money. They just didn't take it for research. They didn't take it for research and development, but they did. They did contract with the U.S. government for 100 million doses. The Trump administration just pre-purchased those to. Yeah.
Right. Right.
So there's that. But yeah, no. We do expect that there's going to be some complementarianism here with how these vaccines are rolled out. Just because, there is going to be the more centralized logistics strain, and then they're also going to be distributed along more retail pathways. So the bulk of it will first go to people who are at high priority for vaccines, but as time goes on, they're going to ramp up more retail distribution of this vaccine, like flu vaccines.
And it's still a two-shot vaccine, right? I mean, you get it one day and then wait 2 or 3 weeks to get the second shot? Or do you know?
Correct. Both of these vaccines require two doses.
I wanted to get your reaction to just get a sense of, you know, the dark winter that Joe Biden is describing and other Western European nations describing, too, thus the basis for the lockdown policies. But even in Sweden, the prime minister there, who I believe was the guy from The Muppet Show, was a chef. I can't remember. But he announced public events of more than 8 people are now prohibited. Now, schools are still staying open there. And restaurants are staying open. You can still indoor dine, no more than 8 people, and so on and so forth. But to restrict public events back down to 8 people from, I think they were at 300, that is still a restriction and a move. So what does that say about where we are with the spread?
I would say that that's probably the number restriction I've always found to be a rather dumb restriction. Because the virus doesn't care how many people are in a space. The virus really cares about the distance between persons in a space. So if you have 8 people in a convention hall, then I really am not really concerned about transmission there. As has always been the case, what we really should have been doing is focusing A, on risks, and B, on the virological reality of transmission. The sort of metrics, the parameters that we've set up in different states, a lot of them are just untargeted, and they're frankly dumb.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I mean, I you know, some of this strikes me as common sense too. We were talking about it the other day with respect to restaurants. You know, I can't eat in my home according to my governor with family, but I can go out to an igloo outside a restaurant in Chicago and sit with those same people outside. You know, with the same distance apart. I don't really understand that. Or I have to wear a mask when I'm standing up with them, but I don't have to wear a mask when I sit down 6 inches away. It seems to me that so much of this is sort of arbitrary to try and carve out some semblance of civilization when what they're really trying to do is, you know, sort of an invasions of the body snatchers, put everybody in a hyperbaric chamber.
Right, exactly. It is all arbitrary, and we see this with it's not just arbitrary; it's arbitrary enforcement of the laws. We see this with Gavin Newsom, and I'm sure in his gigantic mansion he can safely distance within the household. But you know, not everyone has that. But everyone should be able to have the right to assess the risk for their own family and then make decisions accordingly. Like, I don't think nobody doesn't know who's at risk by now. Everyone knows by now. I don't think anyone is going to be trying to put their great grandparents at risk at this time. It's just people can be trusted to care for their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin, I can't go to, I'm an Episcopalian. I can't go to church in Illinois, but I can go to a strip club and a casino.
Yeah, I was in Vegas and I was able to do that. I was able to just walk into a casino, but I had to register at a parish to go to church on Sundays. And That's not an ordered society.
No.
He is Dr. Kevin Pham, medical doctor, contributor to the Daily Signal and former graduate fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Kevin, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.